You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for July 31st, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the Republican Hold My Hair contest, it's The Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
Hat tip Mark Maron.
Yeah, hat tip Mark Maron.
That was a very funny episode of Mark Maron with the hold my hair.
Yeah.
But yeah, this debate is going to be a hold my hair contest, at least for me. We'll get to that in a minute.
The hold your hair thing is you drink until you puke on purpose.
Yeah, on purpose.
And then and hold your hair.
Hold her hair. Hold her hair. Yes.
That's what we're looking forward to. So buckle in, folks.
We have a show note to let everyone know that next week we will be recording the podcast on Friday.
Yes.
The reason being that Thursday night is Jon Stewart's last night and also the night of the Republican debate.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that we get all of that in live and, you know, immediate so that we'll have a lot. I don't think we'll have to do any show notes, actually.
No.
We'll just kind of
spew. Just be an hour of me singing Danny Boy.
Right.
So, yeah.
But it is interesting to me that when your opponents publicize your debate and say, everybody has to watch this.
Yeah.
The Democratic Party is sending out email reminders to say,
don't forget
Fox News on Thursday night. That's a sign that something is terribly, terribly wrong.
Well, I told you my strategy, my brilliant strategy for winning.
What was your strategy for how to win this Republican debate next Thursday?
All right. I hate to do this.
No, you don't.
No, I don't. And in a sense, it'll never happen. It doesn't really matter. If you're Jeb Bush or Scott Walker or any of the other horrible candidates, but people who are taken seriously by Morning Joe and the New York Times, what I would do seriously is I would show up in a Hawaiian shirt, jeans, and flip-flops with a Mai Tai.
Cut off jeans.
Yeah. And say, basically, fuck it. Since this is just a clown show, since that man at the end of the podium there, that guy with a funny thing on his head, is not a serious candidate, since he's a clown.
And this is being hosted by Hugh Hewitt.
Yeah.
Wait, he's an intellectual guy. You know, he's a thinker.
He's a thinker. since this is where we're at in our politics, and since I can't control that, you know what? Let's have a good time. First question. What do I think of Hillary Clinton? I think she's hot, man. I would totally tap that. I would totally fucking tap that. And you know what? Not about her policy. I have a thing for pantsuits. She's always done this to me. I've been walking around with a raging boner for 30 years. Her policies are terrible, but let's face it. She's a hot lady. And Bill Clinton, you know, my man. Next question. And you would treat it as the colossal buffoonery that it is.
Yep.
And you would say, look, if anybody wants to talk policy about really serious things, I will be outside in the parking lot after the show to talk policy with you guys. But clearly, since Ben fucking Carson is here, and since
he's taken more Ambien than I've drink in Mai Tais.
Since we have 10 people on the stage, and in case anybody drops dead, we got 10 more waiting off stage.
Yeah.
It's a clown show. This is completely entertainment. This is a complete farce. So I'm going to honor our host by treating it as such. Because if they were serious about this, if there were serious policy people who wanted serious discussions, that idiot at the end of the stage wouldn't be here. But he is.
Yeah, the current front runner would not be talking in the media about tapping Sarah Palin for a job in the White House.
No. And so I would treat the event with all the respect it deserves and show up in my Miami Beach, I'm here to party outfit, maybe with rollerblades, I don't know, maybe roller skates, I don't know. You know, the outfit that Archer wore to show he was gay? Maybe that.
And those little pink pants.
Maybe really, really short shorts, a tied shirt that says, got dick. And, you know, and because...
Maybe with a picture of Cheney there, got dick.
Because, swear to God, you're going into the mud pit with the king of the pigs.
Well, and Driftglass, you had another good analogy. You were talking about the work truck.
Yeah.
Outside of Home Depot.
It really is.
Which, by the way, Home Depot, I still boycott Home Depot, not only because they're not local, but because, you know, they paid for Bush's second inaugural.
They did. They did.
So just remember that when you're shopping for lumber, okay? Mm-hmm. But the work truck that comes by for day laborers.
Yeah, it is. That's what it is.
Home Depot.
It's the labor truck.
It's like Roger Ailes is driving the truck up, and there's 16, 20, 25 guys waiting.
Okay, who wants to work today? I got jobs for 10 people. I got jobs for 10 people. Who wants to work today? What do you got? My coach could be, Hitler, Hitler, Hitler. Okay, you can get in the truck. What about you, Trump? I agree with Huckabee. Yeah, you're nuts anyway. Get on in. Y'all potheads might as well smoke up now, because when I get to be president, I'm shutting all this shit down. That's perfect, Chris. Get in the truck. You're an asshole. Get in the truck. And it is the labor van. It is the, you know, how fucking nuts, you know, do you have to be to, and is just a primal scream for attention from people who are, have no business being in this process at all. But really, that is the story of the Republican Party. The Republican Party has no business as a party participating in the politics of this country. They are completely, they flunked citizenship. They're completely.
That's right. And that's what, you know, Rachel Maddow said to I can't anymore.
That's okay.
Pennsylvania yeah. Senator Rick Santorum.
Pennsylvania Senator.
You know, I have to question you on your civics because you really don't understand. And I want to talk for a minute about what this summer has been, because it has been such a great summer for attention whores.
Yeah.
Sarah Palin coming out against Planned Parenthood. They got her on TV.
Yep.
Got her back on Fox. And then we heard from Camille Paglia.
Yeah.
Who I thought was dead.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm
halfway through a post about the editor of Salon mm-hmm. had to go empty out his father's effects
from the 90s
because he passed away. He found like the old Vanessa Williams penthouse cover. He found the Terminator on VHS, and he found Camille Paglia.
There she is.
Oh my god, she was in a sock drawer the whole time. And this is a total inside joke for one person only. But honestly, I thought Bun Bun Stew was the only creature that could fire shit like a machine gun. But no, I'd forgotten how truly proficient Camille Paglia is at just dish galloping bullshit.
Since that guy who reads the rules at the Oscars.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. And she has, there is no reason for her other than there's someone named Clinton in the race. Oh, shit, the 90s are back. Who do we get? Hey, who is that crazy lady who talks a lot of shit? Yeah, and of course, I skimmed the fact that she's now in Salon for some reason.
Well, and what again. She said to get attention was she said that Bill Clinton and Bill Cosby are basically the same.
Basically the same. And it's about necrophilia and powerless women. Mm-hmm. And really, aren't they pretty much the same?
Oh, she's such an intellectual. Listen to that. Yeah.
She is. And then okay. She talked about how Fox, she has nothing bad to say about Fox News. Liberals are the real intolerant ones, Blue Gal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, and from there, mm-hmm. We're off to the races. And it is, it's the summer of really stomach churning violence.
Yep.
And completely unhinged attention whores on.
Well, and those two things are related. Because gay marriage, the upholding of Obamacare, and the Confederate flag coming down. And I would add to that Obama's lame duck fuck you tour.
Yeah, his trip to Kenya.
But in his general attitude is, mm-hmm. my critics, fuck you.
Yeah, you're idiots. You're
obviously deficient at factual content.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is leading a group of already paranoid people to really need to lash out.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
And but I found it really interesting this week. The death of Cecil the Lion.
Yes.
Just took over Facebook.
Yeah.
This week.
Mm-hmm.
And several people in my timeline commented, look, I have to leave Facebook now because the same deadline is coming up 300 times.
Right.
And I just can't take it. And Steve S. on Facebook today, after, you know, we've kind of been through this, said, you know, and I'm quoting him, this all feels weirdly disproportionate.
Uh-huh.
and a waste of rage, all of the world's problems to cause this particular massive response.
Mm-hmm.
Is a single dead lion really where we should focus our energy, he asks.
Yeah.
And so I've been thinking about that and why this particular issue sort of took over people's heads this mm-hmm. week. And I really think it's a proxy war against the 1%. You know, you have this white guy, wealthy individual mm-hmm. with a gun using his power overseas. You know, it's Dick Cheney all over again in some respects. And you're able to narrow it down to one person doing one thing that is horrific.
Yeah, it is a stand-in.
Yeah.
And it's one rich white
asshole,
Republican asshole using his money to go out of his way, travel halfway around the world to kill something beautiful because fuck you, I get to do that.
Yep.
And that's it. And coming home and not understanding why anybody's mad about it.
Yeah, well, and he's sorry that it was a local favorite.
What?
And not that it's an endangered species, you know. That's sort of.
And it's that level of perversion.
The idea that you have to lure it out of its protected space to shoot it should have been your first warning.
Well, the idea that you are spending a year's salary for the average American to go halfway around the
American planet. Couple.
Yeah.
An average American couple. Yeah.
To kill something beautiful.
Yep.
And you don't understand why that is horrifying. You don't need to do this anymore.
Yeah.
You don't need to kill for food or for protection mm-hmm. or any other mm-hmm. reason. Mm-hmm. We have broken the planet. We have driven nature to the brink of extinction. Now is the time when going out of your way to say, fuck you to nature.
Mm-hmm.
I get to kill anything I want because I'm a human being, because I'm a rich white man from America, is the signal for the 1%. It's the signal for
symbol.
U.S. intervention.
Yeah, it's
the
symbol
for global warming. It's fuck you.
Yeah,
I don't care.
Fuck the planet. Yeah.
If the planet's screwed up after I'm gone, I don't care. I have enough money to be comfortable till I die, and after that, who cares?
And so I was kind of scanning Facebook for other thoughts about this, and someone pointed out Samuel DuBose getting mm-hmm. shot by a white cop in Cincinnati. One person on Facebook called it isolated incident number 261. There's that. And then Sandy Hook. I was thinking about Sandy Hook all week, that 20 kindergartners didn't change the gun laws in the United States of America. But the dead lion may change international law.
Right.
Over hunting and mm-hmm. whether Americans can get visas to go to Africa for the purpose of hunting big game. I mean, mm-hmm. this is people are so upset about this. And I do think it's a proxy for a lot of other things.
It is.
And that's, you know, that does not diminish the issue in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not fight proxy. Let's fight the war.
and there's a certain sense, and this is why people, you know, we have pets and people love their animals, mm-hmm. that pets are, animals are sinless in a way.
Yeah.
They are not, and which is not to say anybody who gets shot by a cop is. Human beings fighting each other is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
A human being going out of his way to kill something completely innocent and beautiful and which is on this earth for us to care for.
And this is when it comes down to Planned Parenthood again, though. This is the false equivalence of Planned Parenthood and Cecil has come up over and over again on Facebook.
Yeah. Well, that's why I say the fuck off Facebook. Twitter. 261, why I stay the hell off of Facebook.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about this some more because it's been a week. I mean, this has been a week of just displaced rage on social media.
It's been a week of what I've noticed, because we're preparing for the podcast and I'm going through mm-hmm. my notes and going through the news, and a lot has happened. Very little of it has been reported on.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a week of let's avoid talking about things that are scary.
Mm-hmm.
Let's avoid talking about things that are terrifying. And there's some very big exceptions in that pile. One is Paul Krugman. We'll get to him in a few minutes. But yeah, it's been a week of displacement and rage.
And the rage that's going on about Planned Parenthood is based on a lie. a libelous edited videotape, mm-hmm. Which, by the way, the court in California today prohibited this fake organization from releasing any more videotape because it's all edited and is clearly designed to destroy in a libelous way an organization.
So the liberals are once again ganging up on the people.
It's the activist judges that are the problem. So
everyone knows how this play goes.
And I was telling you about this, and you got after me about reading the comment threads. Don't read the comments, right? Protect yourself. Don't read the comments.
It's for you, honey. It's for your own good.
And he is good at pulling me off of social media when I get depressed. Uh-huh. But this was a funny satirical article in this website that I never heard of before called Liberal Darkness, uh-huh. A Little Light in a Crazy World. And I'm just going to read the title of the article so you can see how satirical this is.
Sure.
Genetically engineered beluga whales are attacking Christian families with homosexual chemtrail water at SeaWorld. First of all, there's an awful lot of hit bait in there.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of Nuke the Baby Seals for Jesus.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There you go. In the comment threads of this article are some serious conservatives talking about how persecuted they are over gay marriage. Mm-hmm. For real. In an article about homosexual chemtrail water at SeaWorld. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know why? Because their relatives have told them to shut up already. You know?
There's nothing in here about Jade Helm.
Right. Their kids and their cousins and brothers have told them, all right, Phil,
enough.
Shut the fuck up already about Vince Foster and chemtrails. Shut up. And he has no place else to go. There are commenters like this on the Morning Joe Twitter stream, which is pretty much the only thing I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're the same people.
Yeah.
I mean, literally the same. Could be nine different people, but the voice is very consistent.
Oh, yeah.
Who are constantly on.
Because it's Alex Jones and The Blaze and
it's
Twitchy. And that's same, who's feeding.
The same person. Literally the same three people, four people are attached themselves like barnacles to Morning Joe. Then they switch over the weekends to Steve Kornacki. Mm-hmm. And they switch to Melissa Harris Perry.
Okay.
And they're absolutely, they never sleep. Wow. And they are all up, and they just are this constant, it's the same people over and over again. But what fucking life do these people have? There's no part of their brain that is functional anymore, that accepts input from reality anymore. And every issue, every outrage, every problem, every Cecil the Lion, is a way to talk about
their issue.
Why liberals want to kill babies to make money.
Yeah.
And there's no hope for them. Those people are beyond redemption.
Well, now when you say redemption, Driftglass, that's a signal it's time for Bible Bitch.
It usually is.
Bible Bitch.
That's not scriptural. And we are going to go back to Paul. I'm sorry, but kind of have to.
We're doing two Pauls this week. Yours is first.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you've got one too?
Okay. Paul Krugman. Yeah.
Well, Paul Krugman. Yeah. Yeah. The other apostle.
Apostle Paul. Yeah. Yep.
Paul, hold on. I think it's 1 Corinthians 4. Let me just.
She thinks it's 1 Corinthians
4. No, I think it. No, it's 2 Corinthians 10. I'm so sorry. 2 Corinthians 10. And because we have listeners who are as familiar with the King James Version of the Bible as I am, I'm going to start with that translation. And then I'd like to share a couple other translations because how it is translated is interesting to me. But the King James Version, which if you have heard this said in a movie with a British accent, would be the version you would hear. Though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations, and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Okay, so that's the poetic, old-fashioned, King James, beautiful King James version of what Paul said.
What the hell are they talking about, Blue Gal?
Well, the Phillips translation of the New Testament says, the truth is that although, of course, we lead normal human lives, the battle we are fighting is on the spiritual level. Mm-hmm. That's a really good way to look at it. But I love the message, which is the modern translation. And I love the King James Version, too. I grew up on the King James Version. Mm-hmm. But for political purposes, the message is unparalleled.
Sure. Okay.
And here is what the message translates Paul's words as. The world is unprincipled. It's dog-eat-dog out there. The world doesn't fight fair. But we don't live or fight our battles that way, never have and never will. The tools of our trade aren't for marketing or manipulation, but they are for demolishing that entire massively corrupt culture. We use our powerful God tools for smashing warped philosophies, tearing down barriers erected against the truth of God, fitting every loose thought and emotion and impulse into the structure of life shaped by Christ. Our tools are ready at hand for clearing the ground of every obstruction and building lives of obedience into maturity. And so I see that a right winger could use this passage against gay marriage and against abortion and against
sure.
Planned Parenthood. And I don't care.
Right. Right.
That is not the point.
No.
The point is to be mature, mm-hmm. to recognize that there is truth and that, you know, it broke my heart to hear Ta-Nehisi Coates on television say that Martin Luther King was wrong, mm-hmm. that the arc of history does not bend towards justice. It bends towards chaos. That's mm-hmm. what he said.
He did.
It is our job to bend it toward justice, in my opinion. And the way you do that is to be a grown up.
Right.
And that requires recognizing gray areas of morality that yeah. involves people who think differently than you do. That requires tolerance of differences. And it requires, I believe, dependence on truth to get things done. And this Planned Parenthood thing is entirely based on a lie. Mm-hmm. And I pity people who feel so wrapped up in their own sense of morality, false morality, in my personal opinion, that they think it's perfectly okay to doctor videotape. And at first, frankly, I think the people who are doctoring the videotape, I don't even think they have a dog in the fight of abortion. That's not what they're after. They're after money and they're after power. Mm-hmm. But whipping right wingers into a froth is always done on the plate of abortion. It just is. That's the guaranteed cash register. That's the guaranteed place to get the people most upset, your mm-hmm. people. And we have to be more mature than that. And more honest. I wrote to Congress mm-hmm. via Planned Parenthood's website, but I put my own paragraph in there, and I did not hold back my religious fury mm-hmm. against Congress people, elected officials who are using this doctored video to try to cut federal funding for Planned Parenthood. And I told them they were going to go to hell for that. I said, liars go to hell, you know.
You know that, right? You know that, right?
I mean, mm-hmm. tend to your own sins. And if you're going to use this doctored video, base your policy on, you're going to hell. And I have no, God have mercy. I said, God have mercy on your soul. And I got an acknowledgement of my letter from the Republican congressman. And I got an explanation from Dick Durbin. Uh-huh. And Dick Durbin made it clear that regardless of this current controversy, he really just sidestepped that issue and mm-hmm. said, Planned Parenthood provides health care to an awful lot of women.
Yeah.
And I'm going to protect their funding. That's my job.
Period.
And period. So.
And that's good enough.
Good enough.
That's yep. good enough. That's good enough for today.
Yep.
That is sufficient unto the day.
Yes, it is. But the stories that were not covered, you can go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, it's we've built up a little bit of a catalog of stories that were big for a day and then went away.
Mm-hmm.
And it is instructive to me to go back to them, and maybe I'll write a longer dissertation someday about why these stories are ignored
mm-hmm.
Because they're uncomfortable, because they directly challenge the prevailing narrative.
Mm-hmm.
They are the evidence that the prevailing narrative is bullshit and it's uncontrovertible. So we're not going to talk about those stories. I would like to talk about This Week in Both Sides Do It.
Yeah.
It was,
and I did send a tweet out saying that if Driftglass, Mr. Electrico on Twitter, had a dollar every time a paid journalist went full Driftglass, we could pay off our house.
Yeah, yes, we could. It's and there was another one tonight, and I'm delighted that people are saying there seems to be something up with that conservative. They're not right in the head. They're funny in the head, in a bad way. And maybe conservative media has something to do with the fact that the Republican Party has stopped being a party. And there's a Harvard study that this woman completed. It's extensive and fabulous. And my joke was, that's great. And if I ever get a job, that pays me anything for anything like this that I do, and not contributions, which we deeply appreciate, but actually puts me behind a keyboard and gives me a check every couple of weeks for doing what I do, I would just go to a beach somewhere and reprint old blog posts. Because I would update them.
6 years.
Yeah. No, 10 years. I did 10 years with the post. And I look back at stuff I wrote in 2006, stuff I know I was thinking in the 2000s and 1990s, and it is both amazing and completely unremarkable that people are going, wow, and it's good to see. I'm glad to see it. But I have a really bad feeling that I know how this rodeo goes. Mm-hmm. And here's an example. Paul Krugman, bless his heart, who's not one of those people that I sort of shake my head and go, oh, yeah, late to the party, Krugman. Yeah, yeah, picking through my old blogs, pulling out my old adjectives. No, Paul Krugman has been doing this sort of thing on the New York Times editorial page and in person for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Give him credit. He had to be born.
And he has done that within an environment and an atmosphere where either he is just as safe as David Brooks, although I don't see how he could be.
He doesn't mention David Brooks by name.
But he never mentions David Brooks by name because he can't.
Because he can't. Those are the rules.
Yep.
It's like Senate Rule 19.
Yeah, which they just broke, Ted Cruz just broke. Yeah.
You don't. There's New York Times rule, whatever it is. You don't call a colleague a moron.
Mm-hmm.
You just
a liar.
But here's Paul Krugman talking about the current situation, the current crisis we are in. Mm-hmm. What I would argue is key to the situation, and in particular key to understanding how the conventional wisdom on Trump and McCain went so wrong, is the reality that a lot of people are, in effect, members of a delusional cult that is impervious to logic and evidence and have lost touch with reality. I am, of course, talking about pundits who prize themselves for their centrism.
Mm-hmm.
Pundit centrism in modern America is a strange thing. It's not about policy, as you can see from the many occasions when members of the cult have demanded that Barack Obama change his ways and advocate things he was already advocating. What defines the cult is instead an insistence that the parties are symmetric, that they are equally extreme, and that the responsible, virtuous position is always somewhere in between. The trouble is, this isn't remotely true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important. I say it every podcast, and I say it whenever I write practically, that is the most important issue, political issue, facing us in the media and politics today.
Well, and it was the most important issue when David Broder was alive.
Yeah.
As well. I mean, it's been
that. It wasn't so naked. I mean, you know, it was bad in the 90s, you know, Newt Gingrich and training an entire cohort of Republicans to call people like me traitors and haters and so on, as a matter of course. Changing the Republican, everyday Republican vocabulary to Rush Limbaugh speak was an artifact of the 90s, 80s and 90s. So it's been going on a really long time. But the entire Republican field this time out is a joke. And there is no story to tell other than, holy shit, there isn't a Republican Party anymore.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of interlocking corporations with their, is a trade show for corporations. You know, here's our doll, here's the Scott Walker doll, and here's the crazy Donald Trump doll. It is a joke. And to tell the story simply and factually, you would have to say that liberals were right all along.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to say, holy shit, going back 20 years, the Republican Party has been rotten and racist and hateful and paranoid, and been feeding that on purpose, feeding their base, treating their paranoia as patriotism, treating their rage as something positive, and just feeding a mindless contempt for everybody that isn't in their club as just normal. And people who in the club, the people who as I call, the tribe that rubs shit in its ear. That's just normal for them. That's how they talk all the time. That's how they think all the time, which is why they don't understand why they're being offensive at parties.
Well, and DriftQuest, you talked about the cooling tank of David Brooks.
Yeah.
And the fact is that as long as Donald Trump is the front runner.
In 2006.
Yeah, you talked about that. Right. That he was cooling down the Rush Limbaughites.
Right.
And he was capable of causing mainstream Republican media to pretend that the Limbaughites and the Confederate flag nut jobs didn't exist.
The analogy is a nuclear reactor.
Mm-hmm.
The core of the reactor, the white hot thing at the center of the reactor is the Republican base, the racist, crazy, hateful Obama freak out base.
Mm-hmm.
And then you surround that with a David Brooks coolant, which makes, you know, which allows everyone outside the reactor to pretend nothing's going on. There's nothing happening here. There's nothing really there. And my job as David Brooks or a David Brooks-like person is to tell everyone on the respectable media there's nothing going on here. These are not people to worry about. There's some crazy fringes, but really, Bluegill, aren't there crazy fringes on both ends of the spectrum?
I read an article to you this week. I pointed out an article to you by Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast.
Yes.
Where he actually says, you know, we have to admit that there are some racists at least adjacent to the Republican Party.
Yes, he did.
And possibly in the Republican Party, that we've got some racists in our party and maybe we need to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to you,
wait for
and
it.
I said to you, why don't you predict how this article is going to end?
Yes.
Gave me two choices. I remember this. You said either it's going to end with, and of course, Robert Byrd was in the KKK. So
the Democrats were the original.
But the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's going to say both sides are equally to blame or equally extreme or whatever.
And
I said, ding, 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 ding.
Because it's that predictable. And it's that profitable.
And he really did, for a brief moment in this article, acknowledge that the Trump phenomenon is real because there's racism in the Republican Party.
Oh, it's an open sewer. It's a fucking open sewer.
He didn't say that.
No.
He was tiptoeing and saying, we have to acknowledge that there are some racists in the Republican Party. And they may be adjacent. I think he quoted someone else as saying racist adjacent to the Republican Party because he gets an out because some racists will not identify themselves as Republicans. They're constitutional conservatives, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like packaged liquor.
I'm an independent.
We don't have a bar here, but you can buy your racism here and go next door to your table
and drink
the pool table and you can drink it there. But this is the whole point.
Yeah.
The whole point is it is such an open joke that this is how people who are paid a lot of money to report on politics are required to end every fucking sentence with a preposition that goes, I fear, and this is how he actually ended it, I fear the more people on both ends of the political spectrum are embracing what should be fringe views in America. I can't police the left. But my hope is in writing sound the alarm on the right. And that is, and he's written, you know, same shit. And he has a job. He has lots of different jobs. People pay him money to write this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nobody. And so Paul Krugman.
Let's not forget that he got a publishing contract for the quotable Sarah Palin.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've seen his weirdly bilaterally symmetrical face on television many times. Part of this is just envy, not talent envy, but just really you're that big because I could do this. Here's the thing. I really could do this.
Every once in a while how much money we could make if we switched sides.
Well, we wouldn't have to switch sides. I would just adopt a persona that writes Republican, writes crap like Matt Lewis.
Are Matt Lewis.
Maybe I am. You don't know. You can't know because I never talked about
it. This is why he stays anonymous, people. He's I would not go to bed with Matt Lewis. No, so
no. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate knowing that. That's actually in our marriage contract. There's a long list of people you'll not go to sleep in bed with. And he's near the top. But here's the thing. it's a marketplace.
Yeah.
It's a writer's marketplace.
And one of the things you need to do to make yourself sellable is say both sides at the end of every paragraph.
And if you say both sides, then you get hired.
Mm-hmm.
If you do what Paul Krugman does, that's why Paul Krugman is the rare exception. Paul Krugman wrote an astonishing column that said essentially the political centrists in this country are the fucking problem.
Mm-hmm.
The right's not the problem. It's the fucking centrist enablers who are pathological about pretending that both sides do it. And it really
And let
did.
Me guess, Paul Krugman was not invited on Morning Joe to have his column quoted to him, right?
Never. And he will never will. What this means, in turn, I'm going back to Krugman, is that to sustain their self-image, centrists must misrepresent reality. On one side, they can't admit the moderation of Democrats, which is mm-hmm. why you have a spectacle of demands that Obama change course to support his own policies.
Yeah.
On the other side, they have to invent an imaginary GOP that bears little resemblance to the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's David Brooks. That's his whole fucking job. Yeah. Now, Paul Krugman can write that because he has a job at the New York Times, bless his heart, and he is largely bulletproof when it comes to his profession. But nobody's going to have him on television to talk about it.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to quote him on the Sunday shows. And this column will go where David Brooks' humiliation went, where Bill O'Reilly's a liar went. It'll go right down the memory
yeah.
hole.
Yep. And
nobody
those are the
is going to talk
about it. It's the same hole. It's exactly the same hole.
And that's why
yeah.
That's why it really is, in a very true sense, a conspiracy. Because the truth is not an esoteric, unknowable thing. It's right there in front of you every day. You can see it right in front of you every day. And there is an absolute cartel in the media that says, we're not going to say this. And there has to be a reason for it. And the reason has to be money
and
power.
This makes me want to swing back to Cecil the Lion for just a minute.
All right.
Which is, there is no corporation or lobby, powerful lobby in the United States that is dedicated to poaching.
No.
In Africa.
True.
Okay.
Right.
There are poaching companies in the United States that advertise on Morning Joe and Meet the Press. So.
Very good point.
You know, endangered animals can be in service to capitalism because you can do the endangered animal on your Coca-Cola can.
Uh-huh.
And you can put the cute little, you know, endangered lemur or whatever in your Pixar cartoon, right?
Uh-huh. I mean, absolutely.
Madagascar, that's what that was, you know, animals, cartoon animals were used to market things.
Mm-hmm.
And endangered animals can be used to teach children how to buy product.
Yes. Oh, if
on the
polar
other
bear
hand,
likes it.
On the other hand, Ferguson and Sandy Hook have constituencies in this country that want to keep the problem alive, want
yes.
to keep guns in the hands of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And a police state that is part of the structural racism in this country. You know, there are constituencies in this country that want that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you cannot go full blast against guns or against a police state
mm-hmm.
because capitalism.
Yeah. Won't permit it.
Yeah. And we can't piss off our advertisers. This is why you can't go against the Joe Liebermans of this world.
Right.
That's why you can't go, because there's military industrial complex that wants these weapons to be sold.
Yes.
And wants all this stuff to be traded and wants us to be in a perpetual state of needing to feed the army monster.
And there is one, again, it's reductionist of me and unfairly so, and that's Camille Paglia's job. But it's reductionist of me.
You didn't say
me.
That fast enough.
No, you're right. You're the sound editor. Crank
I have to crank
really
that
fast.
Real fast.
Yeah, this is going to be a 20-minute podcast. We're going to go really fast. There is one question that requires answering. How is it possible that something this catastrophic is happening right in the middle of our country, right in our own backyard? It's on television every goddamn day. And everyone points their camera in the opposite direction and shits themselves and runs away when anybody asks, why are you pointing the camera the wrong way? There's a story over there.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has a platform or enough money or clout or whatever to grab Chuck Todd by the head and turn it and force him to talk about the real problem that's sitting right next to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with the possibly the worst Meet the Press I've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to give you time to talk about Bruce Rauner, so pace yourself here.
I will. I only want to talk about Bruce Rauner in the sense that we'll talk about him in a great deal more at our next podcast. But he is a unique governor in a sense that I heard some people talking.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Tell me about Meet the Press.
Meet the Press, they really embraced the suck this time. I mean, they really did. Chuck Todd, because there's a thing that you and I call Gingrich's Law, the new Gingrich Law.
Yeah.
The Gingrich Rules, rather.
Gingrich Rules.
Which are coined by yours truly, which is states that if no matter how badly Newt Gingrich fucks up on the air, he will be given a pardon within a measurable period of time. He will be brought back on Meet the Press. He'll be brought back on wherever. He'll be... And no one will mention why he got fired or why he got laid off or why he was put in the penalty box, but he will have his reputation restored to him. He'll be treated with respect and deference. He'll be right back in the mix until he does it the next time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no point at which Newt Gingrich is going to be kicked off American television for reasons that nobody will talk about at all. It's the Bill Kristol problem. Nobody will talk about why this fucker, who has no business opening his pie hole ever, is treated as a lionized guest everywhere he goes. And everyone defers to him and jokes with him and laughs with him. So apparently it was time for Pat Buchanan, you know, old racist Hitler apologist Pat Buchanan, to be out of the penalty box.
Unbelievable.
So Chuck Todd has him on to talk about populist campaigns. Didn't you run a populist campaign? You old Nazi-loving son of a bitch, except he didn't mention that last part.
Right.
Because you don't talk about that, because that's rude and embarrassing. And so Chuck Todd had Pat Buchanan on his show. And I really can only think of one other living human being who thinks it's a good idea, and that would be Bay Buchanan, who is even more Pat Buchanan than Pat Buchanan.
She wants equal time.
She does. She's his creepy, evil, twinish sister, who is even more... grotesque than he is. But he's an awful person and has said awful things, and nobody mentioned it. They just had him back on. Pat's here. Hey, we love Pat. And tell us, and it wasn't much of a segment, but it was part of his rehabilitation, redemption. Again, you, as a liberal, I will never be on television.
Yeah.
Liberals do not get on television ever, almost never. And they certainly
They should trust us to be on television. I would go, if I was given a seat on television to talk about the weather in Springfield, I would bring up...
By the way,
I think it's terribly offensive that Republican congressmen are using doctored tape to try to defund Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
And I think you, Chuck Todd, are part of the problem because every other word out of your mouth is both sides. And I'm going to start talking to you about all the ways both sides don't.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to set my own camera up here on the edge of the desk because you're going to cut all this out.
Right.
So this is going on YouTube.
It's going on YouTube.
When I got thrown out of the studio. but it isn't even that... Liberal positions are simply not allowed on television. And yet,
that's why Bernie Sanders is interrupted.
Yes.
Talking about income inequality to say, yeah, but aren't you fighting with Hillary Clinton? Can we talk about the horse race you have with Hillary Clinton? Can we talk about these polls you have with Hillary Clinton? And
Chuck Todd had the perfect cure for Bernie Sanders. He brought Ron Fournier out to explain. Why, even though Bernie Sanders is not like Donald Trump, he's also just like Donald Trump.
Just like Donald Trump. Yeah.
And we'll roll out, again, another David Brooks clone, another both-siderist douchebag who has no observable skill, no observable talent, no analytical ability, but he's a big, limp dick who says both sides in a way that makes the billionaires and millionaires on the Upper East Side... who watch the show, and people in the Beltway who watch the show, cozy and comfortable. He tells them their comforting fairy tale. So he gets to go on television.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't object to having these douchebags on television at all, as long as it's a fair fight. But the fight is rigged. Because any decent liberal could disassemble these people in 2 minutes on the air without having to use the word fuck once.
Yep.
And that's why those people are never allowed anywhere near these people, because they all have glass jaws. And they're protected. Unlike certain lions I know, we protect our TV, our rich TV assholes, and we fet them, and we overpay them, and we kowtow to them, and we bow to them, even as we know, oh, they're full of shit. And frankly, if there's two worlds I have to live in, either well-paid, lying part of the cog in the machine that's wrecking this country, or broke-ass outsider who me and Paul Krugman just sitting on a bench firing spitwads. because that's what it comes
to. Because he's as ineffective as you are. That's the point.
That's the thing. There's a weird level of comfort knowing that Nobel Prize winning New York Times columnist is just as ineffectual and impotent as I am.
Mm-hmm.
Because the machine he's firing at will not be stopped by people like us unless, and here's the important point, unless we all focus our fire on it at the same time and not get distracted every time a fucking shiny object shows up that distracts us from it. If we did that, we have a chance at disrupting the machine that is lying to us all the time, at least for a time, at least for a period.
Speaking of the Nobel Prize, Marco Rubio, who is as stupid as a piece of toast.
Yes, he is.
I would bet on the toast, but... he tweeted this week that John Kerry is trying to win the Nobel Peace Prize and Barack Obama is trying to earn his.
Okay.
Someone replied, I thought was the perfect takedown, which was, on what planet is that a bad thing?
There goes Gandhi showing off again with his hunger strikes and his civil disobedience. God. You know.
Bruce Rauner is an interesting combination, sort of an amalgam of Donald Trump and Scott Walker, in a way.
He has
qualities of both. Would you talk? He is our governor in Illinois right now.
He's our governor. And it's someone to watch. He does not make the news at the national level because he's not running for president yet. But he really is unique. He really is unique among all the governors out there.
He's a billionaire, first of all.
And that's what makes him unique. Yeah. You have in the Republican Party, in politics in general, but especially in the Republican Party, a concentration of deeply invested billionaires who want to buy states one by one and then buy the federal government. And Scott Walker is a walking sock puppet for the Koch brothers. He is simply their local manager. Charlie Pierce calls him the guy, the homunculus, who runs their Midwestern their Midwestern franchise, formerly known as Wisconsin. That's his job. And he got tripped up the first time he'd been in office for a few months. He got tripped up because somebody prank called him as the Koch brothers.
Yeah, right.
And he took the call and talked and sucked up to him and flattered him. And he's that guy. He is a total cipher. He has been raised like veal to be this perfect Republican cipher. And these guys come in with all their money and just funnel it right through him.
Mm-hmm.
But Rauner is the overlap in this Venn diagram. Rauner is a true believing right-wing nut job. And he's a billionaire. And you put him in office, he doesn't have to front for anybody. He can, and he has literally, and I mean this in the literal sense, literally, bought the Republican Party in Illinois. He can fund campaigns for everyone in his party, and does. And there's always the threat that if you don't go along with what Bruce Rauner wants, he'll fund your opposition. And he can do it out of his own pocket. He can whip out his checkbook and make you or break you. And everyone else in the Republican Party has to work for a living at something. He doesn't. There's no financial threat hanging over his head. He can do whatever he wants.
Yep, yep.
And that makes him unique because he's a billionaire and he's a Koch brother, a true believer. And he is running their playbook step by step. And the only thing standing in his way is the fact that there's a supermajority of Democrats in Illinois. And that's a problem all by itself. But that's a problem for a different day. If there were not a supermajority, we would look like Oklahoma or Kansas within a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he has no stake in it because no matter how badly he wrecks the state, no matter what he does, he walks away. He's still a billionaire tomorrow.
Yep.
And that makes him absolutely unique and well worth watching. And maybe in future episodes, we'll talk a little bit more about the antics of Bruce Rauner. Governor Hedge Fund. That's my trademark term.
Governor Hedge Fund.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dirtglass, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Blue Gal.
Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. And there was some discussion of making Cecil this week's internet kitty.
Yeah.
He's had quite a bit of exposure on Facebook this week. And we just decided that we would follow the rule of we post an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners, one of your internet kitties. So... We are thinking of Cecil this week. That said, this week's internet kitty is Connor. And Connor is orange and has a polka dot nose and likes to sit in the grass.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he's very special. So go over and visit Connor at our Facebook page and website. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses... We reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions. Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And also don't forget our Amazon link, Driftglass. We have gotten enough Amazon sales to make a car payment.
You're kidding.
No.
For like a real car?
For like the car that I drive.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's amazing. And
that's found money.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and thank you for using the link at, if you're going to shop at Amazon, and we do promote shopping local, but if you're going to shop at Amazon, go to our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. There is a link there. And I I love how you said, can you buy real estate at Amazon?
Yeah.
Or a car.
Yeah, a jet. If you can buy a jet.
Can you buy a jet at Amazon? Maybe we can get some listener to buy a jet. Right.
Can you make massive campaign contributions?
But listen, it's like you said, it's found money. It's not, you're not sending us any money. You're buying stuff and we get a percent of it. Yeah, we're not asking you to go buy stuff you don't need. You don't have to buy a jet, or a drone. Just buy what you're going to buy at Amazon anyway. Do it through our link at professionalleft.blogspot.com. And eventually, maybe we'll pay off our car.
Who knows? If you're thinking of funneling a couple of $100 million into, let's say, I don't know, Scott Walker's campaign, would it kill you to push some of the money through Amazon? You know, maybe get you closer to going to heaven? I'm just saying, you know.
Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a direct contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. I particularly want to do a shout out to a listener in Japan who sent us a package this week of basically goodies for the kids, stickers, napkins or handkerchiefs. A little doll, some bracelets, some rings, some just stuff, you know.
It's cool stuff.
It's very cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And the kids come home in 2 weeks. So I've packaged all this up for them to open. There's a kimono in there. And just it's things that this wonderful listener said, you know, I'm cleaning out my house and I want to get rid of this stuff. And she's a middle child in a family of 10 children.
Oh,
so
my.
She said, I had two choices when I was growing up. I could do with or I could do without.
We get that.
Yeah. So she cleaned up her house and sent us these things. And it's just, it was a treasure. It's just a lot of fun. And I also want to do a shout out to the Bill Show in Australia. They are expat liberals. Yeah. And they do a very good show from Australia. And they sent us a box of Australian stuff for the kids, which was very fun.
It was. It was
and
really cool.
We've got that all boxed up for when the kids come. They're going to have this international Christmas in August is what they're going to have. So,
what have you people been doing while we were gone? You don't want to know.
We got stuff from overseas while you were gone. Here it is. So I know they're going to enjoy these things. And thank you very much to both of those people. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. And thank you for doing that. Yes. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties are very excited to welcome Fightin' Jim Gilmore to the Republican field. And no, they have no friggin' clue who Fightin' Jim Gilmore is.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovin'. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
All right. Science Fiction University, our friend Dogface Terman asks us a question this week, Driftglass.
Radio God Dogface Terman.
He asks you a question.
Uh-huh.
What has science fiction added to our language? There are lots of pop culture examples like I'll be back and beam me up, Scotty.
Uh-huh.
But are there examples of everyday or even science-related words or phrases that we all are aware of that actually came out of science fiction?
So what has science fiction done for you lately?
or not so lately. Uh-huh. So I went and looked up Google, and found the Oxford University Press blog.
Yeah.
They are the publishers of a book that you actually own called Brave New Words.
Uh-huh.
W-O-R-D-S.
Uh-huh.
It is the Dictionary of Science Fiction, the Oxford Dictionary of Science Fiction, which won a Hugo Award a few years back.
Does it come with its own magnifying glass?
No, it didn't. It's not that tiny, tiny little print. But OUP, the Oxford University Press, published an article on their blog about words that, nine words, which appear to be from science, but are actually from science fiction. Originated in science fiction, yes. So I thought I would read these to you, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Some of them are, I think, pretty easy for you, and other ones might be more obscure. But we'll try them, and then we'll see how it goes. And you just tell me the author that came up with them, and if you're really hardcore, the story which they first appeared. We'll see how you do. But the first one is easy. The first one is robotics.
Okay. Oh, the actual word robotics.
The actual word robotics and robot,
yes. You mean that came from some person? Some person that didn't come out of the Bible or Sanskrit or something? That's oh, yeah.
There have always been robots. Yeah.
That person would pretty much have to be Isaac Asimov. If it's
Isaac Asimov.
Yeah.
He's very famous for his three laws of robotics.
He is.
Yep.
Everyone. And they're very good laws.
They're very good laws. Mm-hmm. And they've even come up very recently on television with Humans, TV show Humans.
Yes.
So that's brought up a lot.
And there's also a wonderful story, I think it's called With Folded Hands, which is what happens when those laws go wrong.
Oh, okay.
What happens when robots don't allow humans to harm themselves at all.
I remember where they weren't allowed to drive in a car because that might be dangerous.
They weren't allowed to play with wooden blocks because you might get a splinter. It's just sit there. And of course, they're atomic powered and they're, you know, stronger.
They're all powerful, so they can actually stop you from going anywhere and doing anything. Yeah. Do you know which story the word robotics first appeared in? And it is an Isaac Asimov story, obviously. But.
Millennium Man or
no? It's a story called Liar!
Okay.
I guess that's where Jeb got his exclamation point. He saw the word liar and he thought, "Oh, I'll just put this after my name." No, Liar! From 1941.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not embarrassed at all. I believe I have a book around here somewhere with Isaac Asimov's illustrated picture on it, and he's got like nine hands and he's typing nine books at once.
I was going to say, it's not as though Isaac Asimov ever stopped writing.
Never. And writing all kinds of things. Commentary on the Bible, science textbooks, Shakespeare, science fiction, you name it. He was a really prolific writer.
All right. Mm-hmm. Number two, the term is genetic engineering.
Joe.
I had no idea that was a science fiction term before it became a science term.
Yeah.
Amazing.
All right. It would have to be 50s or 60s. I don't know. There's a lot of good candidates in that period. I can't think of who was writing good. Maybe even Margaret Atwood, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it could have been her, but and certainly she wrote what I would consider one of the primo novels about genetic engineering, Oryx and Crake, which is just a terrific book. But no, it is Jack Williamson.
Oh, yeah.
His novel, Dragon's Island.
Uh-huh. Oh, I have no idea. But I think Jack Williamson wrote, I have to check this, With Folded Hands, the story I just referenced.
Oh, all right. Well, it's a small world, this world of science fiction.
Full of words.
Also, occupation of genetic engineer took a few more years to be named, this time by Paul Anderson.
Oh, yeah, Paul Anderson, another very fine writer. Yeah.
So number three, and number three has an A and a B.
Okay.
3A is zero gravity, and 3B is zero G. So
okay.
And think of it, I'll give you a hint, zero gravity is actually within the Earth, and zero G is in outer space.
Okay.
So,
all right. Well, zero-G has that kind of NASA feel to it. So I'm guessing it's in the... That's American 50s or 60s.
Yes, and, 52.
Oh, okay. And zero gravity is more... Geez, is this... What time span are we talking? Because that could be... That could be H.G. Wells, for all I know.
Yeah, it could be. It's not quite that early. It's okay. Jack Binder.
Oh.
Who gave us that in that term in 1938.
Okay, all right.
He used it to refer to the gravityless state of the center of the Earth's core. But what about zero-G? You mentioned that it's kind of a NASA 50s thing.
Yeah.
It's from 1952.
Oh, there were a bunch of people writing hard science then. My go-to is Robert Heinlein. It probably isn't, but I'm going to go with Robert Heinlein.
It's Arthur C. Clarke.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. That makes sense.
Novel Islands in the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Number four, deep space, meaning outer space in its essential emptiness.
The deep. Well, Cordwainer Smith wrote of the great pain of space, which I think was just awesome. He wrote a whole different kind of worlds. He had a whole different take on the universe. And this is a complete sidebar, but to traverse space, you had to have all of your nerves cut, or you had to be transported inside of a large grove, a globe full of vegetation, I believe.
Ah.
Scanners Live in Vain, I think, was his. It was, I mean, he wrote really cool shit that was completely at 50, you know, at 90 degree angle to what everybody else is writing. But that was the 50s. So it's an established fact. This gotta be an early one. My best candidate for this would be the irreplaceable Doc Smith, E.E. Doc Smith.
You're right. I'm amazed. E.E.
Yeah.
Doc Smith seems to have coined this phrase in 1934. The Oxford University Press is going to give it to him.
Yep. And I bet you it's either in Triplanetary.
They don't give the story.
Ha!
So.
Suck it, OED. Give me a job. I know, because I have those books boxed up here somewhere. I think I still have a paperback versions. He wrote another series called the Skylark series, but that didn't really ever go quite as far as... But everybody knows the Lensman series. Lensman is a big science story, two galaxies colliding, and the primal forces of good and evil at war with each other always. And it's space opera, and it has a lot of, you know, nobody in it has any, shall we say, genitalia. but when you're using entire suns as a weapon, you're doing something pretty cool.
All right. Number five, Ion Drive.
Oh, Jesus.
This is a type of spaceship engine that creates propulsion by emitting charged particles in the direction opposite the one you want to travel.
Yep.
A number of spacecraft have used this technology beginning in the 1970s. This is a real thing now, but it started in science fiction.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of the hard science guys got obsessed with solar sails and Bussard ramjets, which would scoop.
Well, and that solar sails thing is also a reality, the solar-powered...
Yeah. No, not solar-powered. So. You would just unfurl a gigantic, one-molecule, two-molecule-thick sail.
Right.
And the
sun, it would pick up the sun, right?
The pressure from sunlight, literally, the photonic pressure, would cause it to sail.
Wow.
Cause it to move like a great ship. It would have to be real immensely huge, but... It can
That's
work.
Very poetic, too, because that allows you then to have a pirate story in space.
Many pirate stories in space. And there are various iterations of jet engines and atomic engines. So this is probably late 40s, early 50s, maybe
You're
even
correct.
The 60s. And I have no idea. I would have said one of the hard science guys, Fred Pohl, maybe.
This is Jack Williamson again.
Jack Williamson.
The Equalizer, 1947. But you're right. He's one of the hard science guys. Yeah. You are right about that.
Oh, yeah. And there would be no science fiction but for the hard science people.
Yeah.
Really wouldn't be.
Yep. All right. Let's try this one. Number six, pressure suit. A suit that maintains a stable pressure around its occupant, useful in space exploration and high-altitude flights, also in deep-sea diving.
Jesus. Okay, this would also have to be really old. I mean, it would have to be really in the early days of science fiction.
Well, in the 30s.
Okay. Oh, the only one I know of is Smith, but...
Doc Smith!
Oh,
it's
really?
Doc
okay.
Smith again!
Oh, okay.
His pressure suits were made of fur, by the way.
Of course they were. But
alas, this was not replicated by NASA.
Damn
says
it.
The Oxford people.
Yeah, NASA. That NASA movie, That Touch of Mink.
Which we just watched this afternoon. That big delayed space fuck movie, yes, yeah, with Doris Day. Okay.
No wonder space flight's so goddamn expensive.
You got to outfit your person at Bergdorf Goodman, you like Doris
gold
Day.
And, gold and diamonds and minks to fly to space. Well, screw that.
All right. Number 7, virus, as in computer virus.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know this was a science fiction thing either.
Yeah.
This sounds like something that some tech would come up with, but
that's late 60s or early 70s.
It is. It's 1972.
Okay.
And I will tell you who it is.
Okay.
It's Dave Gerrold from Trouble with Tribbles.
David Gerrold. Yeah. And okay. If that's the story, then I know the book. If that's the guy, then I know the book.
That's the guy.
It's When Harley Was One.
You are right. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I have
you
a copy
really
of that book
stories
around here somewhere. Well, I have it around here. But yeah, there were a lot of, there were not a lot of, there were several early computer stories.
You are the science fiction expert, Driftglass. You just are. All right.
I have some stuff I know and some stuff I don't.
All right. Let's try this one.
Okay.
Number 8, worm, as in self-replicating computer program, worm.
David Gerrold, Harley.
No.
No.
Although, you know, he did write about computers. You're right. That was one of his things. But
I don't know. That same period, there were a bunch of people. It is a
70s thing. Yeah. Yep. It is John Brunner.
Oh, yeah. Good writer. No, it wouldn't have been. He had a giant computer in Stand on Zanzibar, which is a very good novel and predicted a lot of things.
One of your favorites. You mention that all the time on Science Fiction University.
Really, I mean, and you don't read it for his predictive abilities, but it really is a great future fully imagined.
Mm-hmm. No, this is from his 1975 novel, Shockwave Rider.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that makes a weird kind of sense.
All right. Last one, number 9, is gas giant, as in a large planet like Jupiter or Neptune, composed largely of gaseous material. Again, I would have thought that came from NASA.
Yeah.
You know, that scientists said this is a gas giant. Large planet made of gas is a gas giant.
Yeah.
But no.
Goddamn, what are we spending our money on? We're apparently giving NASA furs and jewels and diamonds.
That the engineers of NASA are not poets.
No. Well, there are any number of people who work at NASA.
But they read all this stuff, right?
Who have said, I got into this because of you, Mr. Heinlein. Or because I got into it because I watched Star Trek. So science fiction is a great midwife.
Mm-hmm.
To thousands, hundreds of thousands of engineers and scientists and so forth. Mm-hmm. So,
who wanted to make the fantasy real. And they do by adopting these terms as well, obviously. Yeah.
Man, I don't. We knew what Jupiter was in the 50s, by the 50s, I'm pretty sure. So, Robert Heinlein, anybody? Robert Heinlein?
No, it's James Blish.
Oh, okay.
From a story called Solar Plexus, which has been reprinted and printed and so forth. But it's originally from the 40s and 50s and has been in lots of anthologies. So, he came up with Gas Giant as
a good for him.
Solar Plexus.
Good on you, Blish. Good on you. Yeah.
Now, you told me that you were inspired by this question because you had a couple of them, right?
I do. And these are really simple.
These are simple ones. But what we'd like is if people know the answers to these, they should email Driftglass. Leave me out of it.
Yeah. Leave her out of it. This ain't her fight.
Driftglass's email is driftglass99@gmail.com.
Yes, it is.
And we had a fellow blogger, write me this week and ask, you know, what's the best email for you? Because I have Pro Left Podcast and I have Blue Gals Blog and I don't know where am I supposed to write you so that you get it right away. Pro Left Podcast forwards to both of us. So if you want to write to both of us, it goes to both of us.
Yeah.
If you want to write to me alone, mrs.driftglass@gmail.com/my main email box.
Yeah.
And driftglass99@gmail.com will get you to
Yes.
Him. The man.
I have many rivers flowing into my email.
But yeah, we have different, I mean, we're like Hillary Clinton in that respect. Yes. We have a lot of different email accounts.
Yes, we do. And I'm always
behind.
And this
is why I don't think Hillary, we'll talk about that, but yeah. I don't think this email thing is that big a deal. But anyway, so DriftGlass has two words, and if you know the answers to where these came from, write to DriftGlass at driftglass99@gmail.com.
Word number one is cyberspace. Come on.
Cyberspace.
Everybody knows this.
Everybody knows where that came from, but tell DriftGlass
that
you know.
Took my introduction to technology class many years ago. I would use it. I would drop it in. Hey, perhaps you don't know, he said, smoking a French cigarette. Flick, flick,
did you take
ash,
the
ash.
Did you take the computer science class where the first thing you learned was that the operator of a key punch is called a key punch operator?
No.
Yeah, we had to write that down in our notes.
No. Yeah. No. Well, I assiduously avoided computer classes when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went. Straight,
this was in college.
Well, I went straight to work after.
Yeah,
high school.
You did. That's right.
And
that's
I got
right.
my computer training at a company.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not dainty about training you.
Yeah, right. You had to learn programming quickly.
I had to learn programming fast, and I had to learn a whole bunch of different kinds of programs, how to talk to people, and a bunch of other things. But eventually, in a
and then you did go back to school, and they were like, yeah, you got to take Programming 101 and English 101. And everybody's like, wait a minute.
Wait a minute. Really?
He taught me how to do that.
Right. It was very weird. But I eventually ended up I kept coming in out of technology. I taught classes in technology to artists.
Yeah.
And I would not waste their time with a lot of a key punch operator. This is called a CHAD. And it comes out of a punch card. And this is why memory used to be 80 bits long or 80 bytes long. 80 character memory. And then it got to be 133. And by that time, they're all just looking at their phones going, oh, when is this old man going to shut his hole? So I tried to make it more interesting. And part of it, the lesson was the moral conundrum created by technology.
Yeah.
Moral questions about privacy and knowledge and things you can't ever undo once you unleash them and so forth. And but the origins of things like cyberspace, terms like that, and the fact that it came out of science fiction. So that's word number one. Word number two is a little more obscure, but you know, I'm sure the smart kids will get it.
This is number 11. Yes,
number 11, and the word is Waldo, not Where's Waldo, just the word Waldo.
Is let me ask you something: is Waldo an anagram of something?
No, Waldo's a machine.
Okay,
a kind of machine.
All right.
An amplifying machine.
But it's not like Man from U.N.C.L.E. where Uncle U.N.C.L.E. stands for something.
Give me a week and I'll come up with something. No. Right now, it's just the word.
All right. All right. Well, write to driftglass99@gmail.com and let him know what that is.
I don't know if there'll be anything in it for you, but it'll keep you amused for a
few. We've still got some of those science fiction postcards.
We do. Junior Dude found them.
I saw them in the kitchen. So
Junior Dude found them and said, I want them.
Yeah, he did. He really wanted them.
I said,
and
no,
you said you could take a couple.
You could take one, and he picked the best one.
Oh gosh.
No, they were all awesome.
My mom sent those to you.
She did. And they were great. So I'll send out a few of those to the first people who guess both correctly. Or can send along some really obscure science fiction university questions. Hint, hint.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody other than Dogface Herman, let me try this. Anybody other than Dogface Herman or Magnolia E-Publish.
Yeah, those
are disqualified. Because they're workhorses.
Yeah.
They do it for the love of it, and we really appreciate it. And so they shouldn't be rewarded for that in any way. Punished for competence. But if we get a couple of new people in the door throwing us some cool science fiction questions our way, there might be a postcard in it for you. I'm not mm-hmm. saying there will be or won't be, but there might be. So let's have some new people kick into the hat, figuratively.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Now
I will say there are two other people who very often send us things.
Yes.
One is Kevin.
Yes.
Kevin H. sends us stuff, and also Raymond.
Yes.
So are you going to disqualify them? I would disqualify them as well.
Yeah. They're, you know,
frequent contributors to the podcast. Sorry, guys.
They're pretty much part of the show.
Family.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Friends and family members of the Professional Life Podcast aren't as qualified from the content. But that's not fair. We do all the hard work.
All right. Yeah. 10 grain?
Yeah. No, sorry.
10 grain's a if you previously won a postcard,
yeah,
you're off.
Come on, give someone else a chance, man.
All right.
All right.
We've been talking, according to the time clock, we've been talking for 22 minutes. I know that's going to boil down to less, but...
Or after you cut off all my bullshit, it'll be 4 minutes.
Anyway, yeah. 4 minutes.
So, yeah, let's talk about two television shows at the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Okay. Yeah, in terms of quality? Because
yep.
I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I'm not going to spend any time at all on True Detective. Don't watch True Detective anymore. It's a terrible show.
Yep.
I did come up with the one way to redeem the show. Not save it, because it can't be saved. But I believe I am the only one who has come up with a plausible plot twist that might make it, okay,
mm-hmm.
That's all right, that's good. And I've shared it with my wife.
Go ahead and share it.
Oh, if it turns out, is there money in this, if I get this right? If I'm an early adopter and I get this right? Because I really don't want to share this if there's nothing of personal, direct material value.
I'm not going to say it.
Okay. If the character, Paul Woodra.
Who's the motorcycle cop,
the motorcycle
right?
guy, confused, sexuality.
Probably gay, but is going to become a dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who has a background in killing people
mm-hmm.
In Afghanistan and worked for a security firm that's basically Blackwater.
And in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
He's definitely trigger happy in Los Angeles as well.
Well, he is most at peace when he is shooting people.
Yeah. Yeah.
He calms right down. You know, mm-hmm. the rest of the time he's sort of edgy and twitchy. He's very good at battle situations, battle mm-hmm. scenarios. If it turns out that he is in fact the guy in the bird mask, that he
yeah.
has been operated as a truly deeply insider of this operation here by Vince Vaughn's character or somebody.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If he is not who he appears to be, I think he is absent from action enough so that it would be plausible that he would be their inside man. He'd be working for under deep cover for somebody. He's being operated by somebody. And that would explain why he didn't kill Detective Velcoro with a shotgun. You know, he makes a point of mentioning that he used riot shells,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
is what cops use.
But if he's, what you're saying is if he's the one that killed Ben Casper.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
In other words, he is the one that discovered Ben Casper's body. But what if he actually was just there
yeah.
and killed him?
Or he was just is part of that crew.
Mm-hmm.
He's working for someone else. He's working some other agenda that's completely different than everyone else there. That's why he keeps being pulled into stuff.
But you know, there's so many people trying to come up with some alternative as to how do we make this actually work.
Yeah, there's
wanting to make it work.
It's a piece of shit.
I've just been looking. Vanity Fair believes that possibly the Colin Farrell character is dead.
Yeah. And
I mean,
you know what? And you know what? We're all in hell with him.
We're all in hell with him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That would make a weird kind of sense. No, the this episode, again, don't watch it.
Mm-hmm.
It is failing for me and me alone because I'm a weird person. There's a certain kind of virtue in watching how it fails because
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. it was such in such a high pedestal, such a high place, and it had such possibilities. The arc that it is describing as it falls is quite remarkable because
mm-hmm.
it's so bad.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
really, it reminds me of the review of Star Wars Episode One.
Even you know? Red Letter Media?
Yeah. Yeah. It was so bad. Because
the protagonist.
Yeah.
Who is the protagonist in True Detective mm-hmm. this year? We have no idea.
Yeah. The French Revolution. God, people, read a history book. it is, and this guy, I don't know, 10 years, 12 years after the movie was released, reviewed it
yeah.
and spent yeah. 90 minutes. It was this epic takedown. And it was, but at the core of the problem was it was George Lucas was given everything. It was let off the leash. There was nobody to constrain him. There was nobody looking over his shoulder. He didn't hire any directors who knew to sort of rein him in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it looks like here. It looks like, I remember the line from the movie review was, it's like it was written by an 8-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
It was like he just wrote it, and they just filmed what he wrote. There was no review process. There was no nothing. There was no, like, this doesn't make any fucking sense at all. They just shot it the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're
mm-hmm.
stuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it feels like. Because there's this, just this weird, I'll just go to this one scene that's so bad, where our detectives show up at the orgy house.
Yeah.
And happen to, by sheer stupid coincidence, discover every single thing they need to discover in the space of about 10 minutes. Our two detectives on the outside happen to be by the window of the one room in this gargantuan mansion where two of our villains are gathered, twirling their mustaches and talking out loud about their nefarious plans. Oh, look, let us look over the documents that prove that we have nefarious plans. Mm-hmm. And then they put them in a desk drawer and walk away. And then they break into this room that has poorer security than your average outhouse and walk away. They happen to stumble on the moment when the two bad guys are talking about the terrible thing. Meanwhile, 50 feet away, our third detective has been given a drug that makes everyone else happy and her paranoid and crazy.
And kind of sick.
And she stumbles around and she stabs Foghorn Leghorn with a knife. Actually, the character is the rich Texas guy from The Simpsons. I swear to God, they just took him and put him in this thing.
He is definitely a caricature.
He is. I'm rich from Texas, and I'm here to screw you, young lady. Let's go talk about it. And okay, that's great. I don't know why he's there. And that was the thing. I have no idea why any of this shit's happening. And not in a good kind of Raymond Chandler kind of way, but in a bad, holy shit, this is so bad. It's so bad. But she, drugged out of her mind and having flashbacks, staggers down the hall and practically falls face first into the missing girl they've been looking for the past four episodes. And hustles her out past the worst security cordon I've ever seen in my life. And off they go.
Mm-hmm.
They motor away into the penultimate episode. And it's so bad. The other end of the spectrum is Mr. Robot.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was so goddamn good. I think it has taken the wild energy from Breaking Bad, including some of the plot things. You know, our character backed into a corner is forced to become brilliant in a way that you find plausible, but has to really start doing really terrible things.
And I really thought at the beginning of last night's episode, we're recording on Thursday, this week's episode, that this, and there was another article about this. I'm going to start over. I really thought watching this week's episode that I was watching what True Detective wants to be.
Absolutely.
On the screen, as a couple of commenters have mentioned around the internet, mm-hmm. that, you know, True Detective really wants to be this show.
Yeah.
And there's crime and there's criminals and bad people, who have to be placated with technology.
Yeah.
And Elliot's hacker skills come into play wherever he goes.
And you aren't ready.
I wasn't really ready for the skills that he had to work. They work at Iron Mountain.
Yep.
Is it Iron Mountain?
I believe
Steel
so.
Steel Mountain? Iron Mountain? They work at this pristine data center.
Right.
And they work in a jail. In the ugliest jail in New York State, right?
Yeah.
And he hacks into both places.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all criminal, but it's very interesting the two sides of the criminal coin, the white collar criminals that he deals with are just as violent and just as awful.
Mm-hmm.
As the black collar criminals.
Yeah, the drug kingpins.
Really, drug kingpins, yeah.
And there's again, you should not let anyone spoil this episode for you.
No, it's go watch
really
it.
Good. It's really good. But he is confronted in a way that reminds me a lot of Walter White.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. He has to deal with a truly insane and dangerous criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's given an impossible deadline. And the stakes on his failure to comply are incredibly high. And he rises to the occasion and takes command of the situation in a way that you saw Walter White do over and over again as he became Heisenberg. He's really good at this. What he's good at is really bad. And he is... absolutely panicked. I mean, the thing about Vince Gilligan, he would linger on Bryan Cranston freaking out and sweating and shitting himself because
mm-hmm.
he was
mm-hmm.
terrified. He's suddenly in this world where he has to fend off assassins and drug dealers and cops, and he has to figure out a way to be cleverer than anyone else because he can't beat them by force of arms or anything else. And he always figures a way out, and it's usually terrible.
Yeah.
But, and it's something that you just, I mean, there's a, in Breaking Bad where he knocks off all of his enemies in a 1 minute stretch. It was amazing. I mean, just the way the scenes were constructed was breathtaking. And this episode of Mr. Robot had that energy to it. It was really impressive. It did things to characters that only very brave shows would do. And it, again, proceeds with complete confidence in its overall mission. And it balanced three entirely different storylines in a way that was masterful. And you never lost your place. You never knew, wonder where you were. When you're with Elliot doing this thing, you're with Elliot doing this thing. When you're with his colleague, you know totally what she's about. And when you're with Tyrell, and all the relationships are different. All the characters are distinct and unique, and but you have this clearly directorial pairing of men and women, teams of boys and girls under different circumstances, squaring off against each other in different ways. And it was a mighty thing to watch. And I was just, it's thrilling to see someone in command of their craft at that level. And my hat's off to them. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Driftglass.
My pleasure, Blue Gal.
I love you very much.
I love you too.
We'll see you next week, everybody.
We will. This is episode, by the way, 295. We're closing in on 300.
So. Oh, wow. Wow. It'll be September. We'll be at episode 300.
Yes. Yeah. And we're going to probably next week is going to be a little tight because we're going to be eating popcorn.
Well, we'll talk about that during the podcast.
All right. I never said a word. I love you.
Love you too. Bye. Bye.